You will remember that last week we discovered that Nehemiah was one of the exiled Hebrew people in present-day Iran. Some of the exiles had returned to Jerusalem. They had begun the work of rebuilding. They had gone home with great excitement and expectation in their hearts. But the work had slowed down to a halt. This is some 90 years now after those first exiles had returned, and Nehemiah has been asking after the state of things in Jerusalem, and it's no better. The people are still discouraged. The work is no further forward. And last week we saw something of the great burden and concern of Nehemiah for God's name and God's glory and God's people and God's work, and how he gave himself to prayer. And in the course of those 4 months of praying, he discovered that he was to be the answer to his own prayer. So we read in chapter 2, in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before. And indeed, one of the reasons for that was that one could be immediately executed for portraying sadness in the presence of this despotic king. I had not been sad in his presence before. So the king asked me, why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart. I was very much afraid. But I said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? The king said to me, what is it you want? Then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my fathers are buried, so that I can rebuild it. Then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked me, how long will your journey take, and when will you get back? It pleased the king to send me, so I set a time. I also said to him, if it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates, so that they will provide me safe conduct until I arrive in Judah. And may I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the king's forest, so that he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple, and for the city wall, and for the residence I will occupy. And because the gracious hand of my God was upon me, the king granted my requests. So I went to the governors of Trans-Euphrates and gave them the king's letters. The king had also sent army officers and cavalry with me. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about this, they were very much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there 3 days, I set out during the night with a few men. I had not told anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. There were no mounts with me except the one I was riding on. By night I went out through the valley gate towards the jackal well and the dung gate, examining the walls of Jerusalem which had been broken down and its gates which had been destroyed by fire. Then I moved on towards the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was not enough room for my mount to get through. So I went up the valley by night, examining the wall. Finally, I turned back and re-entered through the valley gate. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, because as yet I had said nothing to the Jews or the priests or nobles or officials or any others who would be doing the work. Then I said to them, "You see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace." I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said to me. They replied, "Let us start rebuilding." So they began this good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard about it, they mocked and ridiculed us. "What is this you are doing?" they asked. "Are you rebelling against the king?" I answered them by saying, "The God of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. But as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it." Amen, and may God add his blessing to this reading from his holy word. Now turn with me, please, to the passage read earlier in Nehemiah chapter 2. You don't need to read very much history to discover that there is one thing which binds together people like William Wilberforce, Lord Shaftesbury, Hudson Taylor, Dr. Bernardo, Martin Luther King, and their like. As they looked out on God's world, they discovered different things which appalled them. The slave trade, the exploitation of children, the fate of the unevangelized, the plight of orphans, racism, and so on. They, all of them, had their own dreams, their God-given vision of how things might be changed, despite, in many instances, battling against profound difficulties and awesome opposition. All of these individuals became instruments for change. Each of these men could describe something of the burden that rested in their hearts, a burden that grew as they were gripped by a sense of God's love and God's compassion and God's justice. God had enabled them to identify a need, and he equipped them to do something about that need. These men were not dreamers. They were men of vision, burdened and equipped by God for a particular task, with particular goals in mind. And our world continues to have need of such men. And God's church continues to have need of such men and women. Now, we have already seen that Nehemiah was such a man who was passionately concerned for God's honor and God's glory and the welfare of God's people and the success of God's work. Now, it's one thing to have a dream. It's quite another to see that dream taking shape. And we see that in chapter 2 of Nehemiah. Think for a moment of Nehemiah, who was a valuable and a trusted servant of Artaxerxes, the ruler of the Persian Empire, a powerful dictator in a totalitarian state. Now, in order that the work to which God had called Nehemiah, in order that that could get off the ground, several things were necessary. First of all, the king would need to overturn an earlier decree that he had made concerning Jerusalem. And we find that decree in Ezra chapter 4 and verse 21 concerning the work of rebuilding. Secondly, the king would need to be persuaded to release Nehemiah from his service. Now, the better you are at your job, the more reluctant your employer is to let you go. And Nehemiah was highly valued by the king. We read in verse 6, "When will you get back?" That's the kind of question you ask someone who's your right-hand man. That's the kind of question you ask someone that you depend upon and rely upon. That's the kind of question you ask someone whom you see is useful to you. When will you get back? That was a barrier that would need to be overcome. Then there were practical considerations, travel visas, a secure and a safe passage, building materials to begin the work of reconstruction in the city of God. How on earth was Nehemiah going to broach this subject with the king, and how might the king react when he makes request after request after request? Well, we have before us in this remarkable chapter an example of the providence of God. Nehemiah, you see, had expected to be the one to take the initiative. He was doubtless waiting for the right moment to speak to the king. Have you ever been in that situation? There's something you want to say, and you're trying to work yourself up to say it, and you're looking for the right opening. And there's a measure of tension there all the way along. But you see, the king provided that opening. He became aware of Nehemiah's troubled expression and asked him, "What's wrong?" So often we are concerned about how we are going to raise important matters with others which concern the work of God, only to discover that God provides opening for us. You see, if God is in something, we can expect to see God at work. And the king gave Nehemiah the opportunity to speak. Nevertheless, it's still, you'll notice, with very real anxiety that Nehemiah opened his mouth. He felt he was about to put his life on the line. Courage has been defined as not being so much the absence of fear as faithfulness in spite of it. That's courage. Faithfulness in spite of fear. And it wasn't easy for Nehemiah to speak as he did. And I think we need to be persuaded of the fact that human weakness and timidity do not matter if we have faith in a strong and a powerful God, as clearly Nehemiah did. Look at verses 4 and 5. "I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king." Prayer, then speech. That's the pattern. Lord, help, then speech. This telegram prayer. Nehemiah's request, you will notice, is made succinctly. He had doubtfully rehearsed it over and over and over again. This wasn't a rash or a thoughtless request. You will notice that everything had been thought through. If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my fathers are buried so that I can rebuild it. Verse 7, I also said to the king, if it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates so that they will provide me with safe conduct until I arrive at Judah. And may I have a letter to Asa, the keeper of the king's forest, so that he will send timber and so on. Everything thought through. And in verses 8 to 9 we read that the king gave Nehemiah all that he needed. Indeed, he was given more than he asked for. Prayer changes people as well as things. And Nehemiah's telegram prayer had a transforming effect on the heart of this king. And we shouldn't be surprised by that, because God's word tells us that the heart of the king is in the hand of God. And when the work of God comes up against red tape, and when we see the powers that be reluctant to see the work of God prosper in advance, we need to remind ourselves of that. The heart of the king or the ruler or the prime minister or whoever is in the hand of God. Nehemiah's mission was God's mission, and therefore God could be trusted to overcome every single obstacle and barrier, no matter how great. I wonder if we view the work of God in that way. Do we really believe that? That no matter how great the barrier to God's work, no matter how large the obstacle might seem, it's not too big for God to move. Nehemiah was in no doubt about the source of the king's goodness towards him. He says in verse 8, and because the gracious hand of God was upon me, the king granted my request. It wasn't that the king was having a particularly good day. It wasn't that I found him in a good mood. It was because God's hand was upon me. In spite of his fear, Nehemiah was sure that God would act. And alongside our natural human fear and nervousness, we are able, you see, to have great confidence in God and his work. Doesn't Paul illustrate that so wonderfully in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 3 following, where he says to the church at Corinth, I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling, and my speech was in demonstration of the Spirit and power. Human weakness and fear, side by side with God's power and strength. We need, I believe, to correct the false impression that there must be something inherently wrong with us if we experience some measure of fear in the Lord's service. I think there was not a few of us in the last week engaged in our outreach to the teenagers in Vergede who knew a measure of apprehension in our hearts. Notice, fear did not dampen Nehemiah's vision, nor did it undermine his faith in God. whenever there is a concern to do the people of God good and to expand the work of God and honor God's name, there will invariably be opposition to that work. And we're introduced to that opposition, first of all in verse 10 and again in verse 19. Opposition from outside the city and discouragement from within it. And this helps to explain Nehemiah's approach to the work once he arrives in Jerusalem. You'll notice that he didn't hold a press conference upon his arrival. We read that after 3 days' rest, which enabled him to recover from the exhaustion of the journey, Nehemiah made a secret survey of the conditions of the walls of Jerusalem, and he did that at dead of night. He had been called by God to Jerusalem to do a specific work, and it's always wise to inspect quietly the scene of our labors. I wonder if you can imagine something of the desolation in Nehemiah's heart as he examined the ruins around him, the glory of Jerusalem that once was in ashes at his feet. Are you surprised that he doesn't even give his closest companions an idea of what he's going to do or what's in his mind? Why did Nehemiah begin the transforming work of Jerusalem in such a strange way? I want to suggest 3 reasons to you this morning. First of all, it was important for him to be able to approach the work with a healthy realism. He had to see for himself exactly what it was he was up against. He wanted to be clear in his own mind exactly what it was that had to be done. And an objective assessment was necessary before any plans could be made or published. And so even his companions are kept in the dark. Perhaps he felt it was too early for them to be exposed to the demands of the situation. Perhaps he felt they can't rise to it just now. The second reason follows the first. It was important that he saw the situation and formulated his plan without being unduly influenced by those who'd already been discouraged in the work. Can you imagine Nehemiah trailing around with him a great retinue of the city elders and listening to them say, "It will never work. We've tried rebuilding these walls in the past. You'll never do anything here, Nehemiah. We've tried. Learn from our experience. The task is too great. The difficulties are too daunting." The pouring of cold water upon his heart, with all the potential of dulling his vision. Nehemiah, you will notice, wisely protects himself from the spirit of discouragement which gripped the hearts of some of God's people. He didn't want his vision to be dimmed or dismissed as a bright idea that will not work. The third reason for Nehemiah's secret survey was surely to ensure that he did not tip the hand of his enemy. If they had wind of what was happening, then their opposition would have made it much more difficult for Nehemiah to secure the support of the population in Jerusalem and encourage them to join him in the work. The opposition would have had all the time in the world to marshal their arguments. And so the secret survey is made. Having made the survey, having formulated the plan, you'll notice in verse 17 following, it is made public to God's people. Nehemiah had a clear idea of what he wanted to accomplish, and we certainly can't serve God very effectively if we don't know what it is we're trying to do. And we as a church need to be clear about what we see our objective to be. where we're going, what it is we're trying to accomplish here. We in our days have to build up the walls of Jerusalem. God's name has not only been dishonored in our land, but in our national church. And surely ours too is a work of restoration. And Nehemiah speaks to the people of the disgrace that was theirs in verse 17. They had lost credibility in the eyes of the world. And surely when godless people see churches half filled on a Sunday morning, closed on a Sunday evening, falling into disrepair, sold as furniture warehouses, churches always pleading for a little extra money, too afraid to ask for sacrificial giving, changing one's beliefs to accommodate the latest fashion of the day. The world sees no reason to take the church's message seriously. Is this not part of the disgrace of the church in our day? And are we aware of that disgrace? Look at the basis of Nehemiah's exhortation. He shared his vision, and he described the providences of God which had made it possible for him to return to Jerusalem. He's saying, look, here are evidences that God is at work with us. You will notice that his confidence for the future was not based on the help of a foreign king, nor on his ability to stir a population to respond. It wasn't that he thought, I am a great orator, therefore people will respond to what I'm saying. No. His confidence, you will notice, was upon the promises that God had made to his inmost soul concerning his work. And the people recognized that God had not only spoken to Nehemiah, but had spoken to them as well. And they were of one mind with him in the work. You'll notice here there are no objections. There is not one reservation. And look at the response. Let us rise up and build. They are fired with a fresh enthusiasm for the work of God. And if we cannot see the Spirit of God as the author of that enthusiasm within their hearts, then we are missing something of great significance. Nothing encourages the leadership of the church more than when the people of God say, let us rise up and build. We can do this. This is God's work. This is God's way forward. We can do this. With God's help. In God's strength. I wonder if that is a spirit that infects us here this morning. As we look out on our church, our parish, our nation. Are we dispirited? Do we see only danger and difficulty and hard work? Or do we see, as Nehemiah saw, what it is God intends to do through us? There is, of course, opposition, verse 19 following. But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard about it, they mocked and ridiculed us. What is this that you are doing, they asked? Are you rebelling against the king? We cannot expect to begin any new venture or make any new step forward without experiencing opposition. And whenever the church begins to show signs of spiritual recovery, she is more likely to be exposed to criticism and contempt than to experience respect and admiration. And Satan's stratagem is often to demoralize and embarrass the people of God. Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem were three powerful and influential figures who, with the people under their rule, almost entirely enveloped and surrounded Jerusalem. And they begin by ridiculing the work of God. It will never work. You will never accomplish anything that is worthwhile. You are wasting your time in this place. Now, we dare not underestimate the power of ridicule. There will always be Sanballats and Tobias and Geshems who sneer at any determined effort to press the work of God onwards. And it's not easy to be an object of such ridicule. There is, however, one fail-safe answer to this contempt. It's given by Nehemiah in verse 20. The God of heaven will give us success. And that is always the safest response to ridicule. God will vindicate his work. And if we are convinced, as Nehemiah was convinced, that the hand of God was upon him, then no matter how great the task, we are able to face it with supreme confidence. The God who burdens our hearts to pray, the God who creates a vision for his work, and the God who works in the providential circumstances of our lives, dealing with all of the practical considerations, can be trusted to prosper his work, despite the greatest and most compelling opposition. Nehemiah was not engaged in hopeful speculation, but in the fulfillment of a God-given objective, and as a result, could continue with the work with confidence of heart. I wonder, do we have that confidence in the work to which God has called us in this place? Do we share a God-given vision for our church fellowship here as we seek to reach out to young and old, churched and unchurched? If so, then we are able to say, with the very same confidence of faith as Nehemiah, the God of heaven will give us success. And if we can say that, then we have said all that needs to be said. May God seal his word to all our hearts.